From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Brands like The Gap and J. Crew used to define a lot of American style. They had an it factor, a cool timelessness. If you weren't wearing them, you wanted to wear them. But today, shoppers say they're missing the fashion and value mark over and over again. That's left space for newer retailers like H&M, Zara, Uniqlo, even Amazon, to lure customers away from their stores. Now, store closings and layoffs signal a world of trouble for some of America's signature clothing retailers. This hour on Point, how consumer changes, supply chain changes, retail changes are changing the world of what we wear. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Have your clothes shopping habits changed? Do you browse online for deals before you hit the stores? And do fast fashion brands like H&M make the old standbys feel lackluster these days? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. With me first today is Suzanne Kapner. She covers the retail industry for the Wall Street Journal. Suzanne Kapner, welcome to On Point. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So run us through the sort of parade of horribles here out of Gap and J. Crew land lately. Gap is closing 175 stores, they've said. They announced big closings earlier. I read somewhere, I think, that means that they will have closed something like 40% of their stores in this country?
Well, they're right now, the latest round is they're going to be closing a quarter of their stores in the U.S. But, yeah, you know, just a few years ago, they had announced a big round of store closures. So, you know, they're down from, it's almost about 40% or so. They've been shrinking fast. They can't seem to shrink fast enough to meet the changing demand. You know, it's a big turnabout for this brand, which kind of pioneered the idea of, you know, you put a store in every mall on every street corner and the shoppers will come. And, you know, they have not been coming for a variety of reasons. Mostly, you know, Gap has not had the right fashion for many years. You know, this goes back, it's not just a recent phenomenon. It goes back, you know, at least a decade.
Yes.
They've had trouble. They had one bright spot where they had these colored jeans about 2-3 years ago, and they were sort of ahead of that trend, and you could see their sales really picked up. But other than that, they've really been very flat.
It's so interesting. I mean, clothes are among the most intimate things that we deal with every day. We put them right on our body. People pay a lot of attention where they come from, who provides them, where they're made, how they're made, but how they end up designed and sold gets right at the heart of our lives in commerce. It's not just Gap. J. Crew's in trouble, too. They just had a bunch of layoffs there. Their profits are down. What's going on with J. Crew?
Well, J. Crew, you know, Mickey Drexler, who runs J. Crew, used to run The Gap, mm-hmm. and he's sort of the merchant prince for many years, could do no wrong. But, you know, it's very hard to, you know, have hit fashion season after season. You see the retailers who do it well. It's not an easy thing. And, you know, their fashion got a little bit away from their core customer. It got maybe a little too hipster, a little too Brooklyn. You know, too many sort of jewels and embellishments and, you know, away from sort of the core, you know, day wear to evening wear that their shoppers kind of relied on them for. And they've been struggling to kind of find that middle ground, you know, to keep it fresh, but yet to have like the basics that people want. It's tricky. And both Gap and J. Crew, you know, they're struggling because the way they're set up, it's a disadvantage for them today. They, you know, it can take sometimes a year to source product. And that means you have to really make buying decisions very far in advance before you really know what's trending for the season. And that has hurt them. By contrast, the fast fashion retailers like H&M, Zara, Forever 21, you know, they can design product and have it in their stores within 2 weeks. And then they buy small batches, they see what's selling, and then they quickly reorder what works. And it's just a whole different model, and it makes it a lot easier to get the fashion right.
A year to source product. And this gets right to the nub of it. This is, I guess, when they ruled the universe, they could do it that way. But as you say, fast fashion, with them moving new stuff in all the time, testing, seeing what works and what doesn't, they can do that, I'm reading here, in part because a lot of these companies are what they call vertically integrated. They have their own factories behind them in Spain, or I don't know, Sweden, or does H&M really make it there? Or in the case of Uniqlo, they're out of Japan. How do they do it?
They do. That's a big part of their secret. They own their own factories, and so they can, it allows them much more flexibility with their sourcing. You know, with a company like Gap, they have to go contract to factories in Asia. Sometimes when, you know, even if they have a hit product, they aren't able to go back to the factory and order more in time to get it to their stores. I mean, it's just not possible for them. So, you know, Gap is really trying to speed up the pipeline. They hired a designer from H&M to work on their Old Navy brand, and he has implemented a lot of like these testing methods where, you know, you buy a small amount, you see what sells, yep, you go back and order more. Now they're trying to do that at the Gap, and this probably will help them, but, you know, it's still limited. They'll never be as fast and as flexible as the H&Ms of the world.
These brands are all interwoven, right? I mean, Old Navy is owned by the same company that owns Gap, or owned by Gap, right? Old Navy's doing okay, I'm reading here.
Old Navy is doing okay. It's doing better because it is trying to react a little bit quicker to the fashion trends. It's also value. And customers are still very value conscious. Even though the recession, you know, we're several years out of the recession, people have remained very, very price conscious. And, you know, they don't want to feel like they're getting ripped off. They want style, they want fashion, but they want it at a good price. And that's led to a lot of, you know, you can see how promotional is out there. It's not unusual. It doesn't have to be Christmas to go into a retail store and see 40% off the whole store. So that's made it, you know, very hard for the full price chains to compete.
Suzanne Kapner with the Wall Street Journal in New York. It's so great to have you here. Please stand by. Liz Dunn joins us as well, a retail industry consultant, founder, CEO of Thomas Advisors. It's a brand strategy consulting firm out of New York. Liz Dunn, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What's the problem that Gap and J. Crew and Abercrombie and more are struggling with?
Well, I think that the consumer has changed. The consumer is shopping differently than they have ever before. There are no geographic barriers to the consumer's understanding or access to fashion anymore. I think
what do you mean by that, Liz? No geographic barriers?
Well, you know, we're looking at these big incumbent retailers who are closing a lot of stores. Part of the reason that they're doing that is because you don't need to blanket the country with stores anymore to for the consumer to have access to your brand. They have it via the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the geographic boundary comment sort of plays into this fast fashion import from abroad that we're seeing, and the fact that some of these companies are bringing much better responsive fashion to the U.S. than we've ever seen before.
So those fast fashion companies watch the fashion runways and they will turn around knockoffs in a big hurry. And what? Consumers are aware of how fashion's changing because they can see the images flashing by online all day.
Yeah, the consumer has much different influences than they've ever had before. And so they're very actively engaged in looking at fashion real time via social media, via the internet. And so it's no longer enough for a big brand to say, hey, we're cool. This is what's in fashion. This is what you should buy. That's not the way consumers are shopping anymore. That's not the way that they're learning about fashion. And I think some of the bigger brands have been have struggled to adapt.
Why can't they speed up? Why can't the Gap do the same thing that H&M does, or that this Uniqlo, which has just got 40 stores now? Many people may not know it yet, but it's very low cost, but kind of spiffy standard fashion. Why can't Gap do that? At one time, they sort of drove, I mean, it's a long time ago now, but they were the it brand for American everyday fashion.
They were at one time. I think it's a huge process problem that they have. Basically, the way that Inditex, which owns Zara, is set up just really allows them to be very, very responsive throughout the process. And so they have fabric pre-positioned, they have factories pre-positioned, even if they don't own those factories. And they sort of go with a style, and if it works, they sort of iterate and move on to something slightly different, but that they've already kind of tested and proven. Gap is just not set up to do that. They are really very they've got a huge process where they're designing fabric, they're designing silhouettes, they're really betting on big ideas. And so it's got to be a huge volume idea for it to make sense for them. And I think evolving from that to something that's really smaller fashion ideas that move really quickly in stores is just a huge challenge.
Big and slow versus fast and fashionable. That's ruling these days. Liz Dunn, stand by. Suzanne Kapner. Sylvia is calling from Burlington, Vermont. Sylvia, you're on the air. What do you see out there?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have not been in a shopping mall or boutique in years. I do all my shopping now online with QVC, Home Shopping, eWine. And you've got some of your best American designers there. Now, I'm not talking, I'm not talking your top fellow.
Yeah.
But we've got Isaac Mizrahi, Dennis Basso, Louis Dell'Olio. Also, you've got some of your actresses starting their own lines.
Yeah.
And, on top of that, they don't have any, they go directly from the distributor. There is no distribution.
Just right out of the warehouse to you. But Sylvie, let me ask you, isn't it a pain in the neck at the store? You can try it on, right away, whether it fits or not, whether you like it or not. If you order online, it has to come. If it doesn't fit, you got to pack it up and send it back again and again.
Easy to send it back, for one thing. They have pre-done labels and everything.
Yeah.
And you don't have to go back to the post office. It's so easy. On top of that, one thing they don't have, like, for instance, I bought a Bose radio for $100 less than any store would do it, and I have 6 months to pay for it. No interest.
Okay, price and selection. Suzanne Kapner, maybe brick and mortar retail is doomed, fast fashion included, if it's that easy online, Suzanne.
Well, she's hitting on a real problem for retailers. Customers want to buy stuff where they want to buy it. They don't want to have to come into a store. They want to buy it at home from their computer, while they're out, from their mobile phones, and a lot of brick-and-mortar retailers are scrambling to keep up with this. It's not so easy, but, they are offering things like you can buy online and pick up in store. The problem is, for a retailer that operates stores, you still need people to come into that store to make the economics work. So that's why a lot of retailers are offering these. You buy it online, you come into the store, because when you come into that store, you tend to actually buy more. Just ordering online quickly, the returns are astronomical. It's very expensive for retailers.
It must be. We'll look at that and much more. Suzanne Kapner, please stand by with the Wall Street Journal. Liz Dunn in New York. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about the clothes we buy, the world of retail that brings them to us, and upheaval in the land of Gap and J. Crew and more. Liz Dunn is with us, a retail industry consultant out of New York with Talmadge Advisors there. Suzanne Kapner is with us. She covers the retail industry for the Wall Street Journal. There's a lot to look at here about vertically integrated companies who have everything from that fast fashion retail facing store all the way back to the factory, so they can turn it around and get new stuff to you very quickly. H&M and Zara and Uniqlo, this new one from Japan, and more in that strain. Then there's the online piece coming in here, changing things. Then there's the issue of who's got their finger on the pulse of what fashion even is or should be. On Facebook here, Elizabeth writes to us, "Gap lost me when the clothes just got plain boring. White, navy, gray, black, dull, no nice prints. They seemed overpriced for decreasing quality." I want to look at the style angle of this, the fashion angle, for a moment, if we may. Vanessa Friedman joins us from New York, fashion director, chief fashion critic, the New York Times and the International New York Times. Vanessa Friedman, thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So how did Gap and J. Crew sort of lose the hot middle of what's going on?
I think what's happened over the last decade is this incredibly quick turnover of fashion, and it's happened on every level. It started with fast fashion. It's also hit the highest end of fashion, where consumers have gotten more and more used to the idea that new stuff would come in, every month, every 2 weeks, every week. And soon as as a brand stops being responsive to that or can't be responsive to that, they become boring.
Is this just human nature, and now technology makes it possible? We always want the new thing, even if it's the next day, buy today, ditch tomorrow?
Pretty much. Yeah, I think, you can argue that in a way it's been damaging to us because we've gotten so used to the next. People have stopped really appreciating value and craft and manufacturing. But it is what it is. And, brands like The Gap really have failed to take account of it.
I wonder if there's no impulse. We've got a funny listener here who writes, "During the long historical perspective, Vanessa, during the Middle Ages, you had one pair of clothes that was so well made, such great material, someone would inherit that piece of clothing when you died. And this listener writes, we're stupid to buy crappy, cheesy-made, color-runs-out junk. Buy something better, make it last. Is that even out there for anybody, you know, from the low to the middle end of the market these days, Vanessa?
I think it is. I mean, I think if you look, you know, sort of ironically at brands like Madewell, the, you know, the younger sibling of J. Crew.
Owned by J. Crew, one of right? Their, Madewell?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. One of their selling points is, you know, literally in the name. It's Madewell. It's, you know, it's good quality fabric, good quality material that will last. And, you know, and it isn't super high fashion or super fast fashion or super kind of cool and trendy, but it does have that kind of sense of timelessness.
Suzanne Kapner, talk to us for a minute about the online business model here. People think, well, they don't have to have stores, so they must have great profit margins. On the other hand, you talk about the volume of returns as being incredible. Just clothes shipped out and sent back in waves, I guess. What does that come down to for a bottom line, Suzanne?
Well, it's not good for the bottom line. The conventional wisdom was online retailers, you know, it's a less expensive business model, but it's really just proving to be the opposite because in addition to those shipping costs, you have a lot of variable costs that go into servicing an online customer, whether it's picking and packing that item from a warehouse. You still have marketing costs and what that's doing is depressing retail margins. The more they sell online, you know, the less money they're earning, and they, you know, they have to be there, but it's not been good for their business.
So you've got that volume, but it could still drive out, Liz, over time. Does it still drive out brick-and-mortar retailers in fashion?
Well, I think that it's part of the reason we're seeing store closures, for sure. But there is also this emerging trend. It's not that emerging, but a trend that's going on towards omnichannel retailing. And Suzanne mentioned it earlier, but I think retailers are learning how to fulfill out of their stores and so that they can maybe maximize the value of that inventory. But it's challenging. I mean, if a consumer is going to order four items, only planning to keep one, that becomes tricky for a retailer to manage through that. And increasingly, consumers are expecting free shipping. And so all of it really does pressure profit margins.
Can I ask Vanessa a couple of things here? One is Gap was famous as a kind of American fashion icon. J. Crew the same. Mm-hmm. Does the fast fashion influx from abroad mean that we've interrupted that chain of Americana being repeated and repeated? Are new flavors, international flavors being introduced that weren't before in the big middle of the market?
Well, I think this has been cast slightly as a reaction against American, quote-unquote, fashion. I'm not sure that's true. I think mm-hmm. the idea of America as an aesthetic opportunity, you know, whether it's the West or Hollywood or, you know, the New York City exists and will exist in designer imaginations sort of across the world. Mm-hmm. What this really is a reaction against, you know, American boringness. That has beset retail. So I think, you know, what it will be interesting to see is how they evolve to respond to that.
The other thing we see is fashions repeating themselves kind of in a cycle. I mean, we went back to skinny ties and skinny
endlessly.
Lapels for men. And
uh-huh.
Now if fashion's coming faster and faster, does that mean that we just work through the decades faster? That, you know, yesterday it's 1950, tomorrow it's 1960. I mean,
We're essentially in one giant chronological melting pot at the moment, you know, 80s plus 70s plus 60s plus 90s, you know, and it mixes and matches in ad infinitum.
I wonder about pricing here, Suzanne. I mean, I'm reading about a, what do you call this kind of denim? Selvedge denim, is that what it's called? And a factory in Hiroshima, of all things, that makes this nice denim for, I think it was, J. Crew and somebody else and this new store, Uniqlo, making that denim for all of them. But the jeans, as they get sold, sort of, you know, maybe one is $50 and one is $90 and one is $190. What about the pricing strategy of the different players, Suzanne?
Well, you know, I think brands like J. Crew actually tried to improve the quality. They didn't just raise prices. They actually tried to improve the quality using Italian cashmere and, you know, other higher-end materials. And in some ways, that almost backfired on them a bit because their pricing went so high, it turned off their core shoppers. So it's like a real balancing act. You know, on the other end, you have the fast fashion retailers where you wear something once and it falls apart. And, you know, that's not great either. But getting that, you know, it's a mixture of art and science trying to get the, you know, the right quality material and price it right. It's not an easy thing to do.
I mean, Liz, is there some dovetailing here with what we hear about inequality and lack of wage growth in this country? Is that pushing down prices slash quality because Americans can't afford better in many millions anymore?
Well, I think there are a lot of factors at play. Certainly the economy and the economy specifically for that lower income consumer hasn't been the wind at the back of shopping. But I think the other factor is that consumers have just so much more pricing transparency than they've ever had before. And so one thing that the internet has done is just allowed consumers to very quickly go online and sort of see what other prices are out there for similar items. And so that challenges challenges retailers to really make their product stand out for value. And maybe value doesn't necessarily mean the lowest price out there, but a recognizable value to the consumer so that the consumer says, I think that this item is worth what they're charging. And that's where J. Crew seemed to have gotten a little bit off track. But I think it's an ongoing challenge for all retailers, given the pricing information that's out there now.
It's so interesting to see reader comments online. I mean, there's a lot of dissatisfaction, like J. Crew was my go-to. They sort of abandoned me, or others who just – Anne writes to us on Facebook, the clothes everywhere, all caps, are awful. I can find better style at the thrift store or online consignment shops. Sue says, I'm going back to my sewing machine. I worked in the garment business for almost 20 years, 80s and 90s. The quality of what's out there today is absolutely awful, even at the higher end. Carly says, sewing my own clothes, shopping at thrift stores. Screw the Gap. Rosemary in Council Bluffs, Iowa. Rosemary, you're on the air.
I am, and hi, how are you?
Very well. What do you see? Thank you. What do you see?
Well, there's an absolutely other side to this. We are renewing, recycling, reusing. More people are shopping at used and consignment stores now than ever. We have one here in Council Bluffs that's packed on the weekends, and guess what? We can find labels with Old Navy, Gap, J. Crew. Excuse me.
And are people going for the price or the fashion,
yes,
the older fashion,
yes,
or what, Rosemary?
Fashion and price, and they can find it in renewable places like that. My girls are hardy shoppers there. My granddaughter graduated from college a couple years ago.
Yeah.
And for the first time, we took her to buy all brand new clothes because she's going to start teaching. But she's right back shopping at the used consignment places. And you find quality things there. And I've gone back to my sewing machine if I need to tweak something. And Tom, I met a gal before I retired at the university. Her suits were beautiful. I asked her where she got them at. She came up very quietly and said, I buy them at the Goodwill.
Well, okay. Wherever you find what you love, Vanessa, if it's all scrambled now chronologically, and I don't know how big the consignment or the second time around market is, but are we seeing that also play into fashion, what people are wearing? They're sort of abandoning the new retail beam in some ways and jumping wherever they land.
I think what you can't underestimate in fashion is the allure of the special and the, you know, the exclusive and the not everywhere, the non-ubiquitous. And, you know, that's one of the reasons that H&M and Zara have been so successful, because even though they have a lot of stores, they're constantly putting new stuff in. So if you don't go into the store at that moment or go in online at that moment, it's likely you'll never see that dress or be able to get that dress. And your friend might have a completely different dress.
Yes.
So they've managed to create an aura of, like, you need to keep checking it because you might get that special thing and then no one else will have it.
Yeah.
That, you know, also belongs to, for example, consignment stores where you can get clothes that aren't made anymore and therefore no one else can have them, or, you know, niche specialty, you know, makers on Etsy, or, you know, places in Brooklyn making that hand-sewn pair of jeans that no one else can have. And that is really, I think, the single biggest kind of carrot for consumers today.
Liz, this goes back to the industry structure, that you've got your very big players who are in trouble here, who order long in advance, as Suzanne describes to us, and then just have to wait for it to come in. And then the fast fashion, where they've got new batches all the time, there's more of a kind of bizarre feeling about going in. You see what you see today, as Vanessa says, maybe gone tomorrow.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the consumer is more individualistic than they've historically been. And so they are looking for that special thing, not something that's mass produced and that they're going to see on, you know, five of their friends. And I do want to weigh in on the consignment and thrift model. I think that's a very big trend for the millennial consumer as well. You see it with some of the websites that have popped up selling thrifted items, and millennial consumer is just very value conscious and looking for something that's special.
Can I ask, I don't know who's got expertise on this front, but maybe Vanessa, I'll come to you. Is there a difference in fabrics between these different retailers as well? And I don't just mean quality versus poor quality or cheap, but I see new and interesting fabrics popping up. I associate Gap with kind of heavy cotton, but Uniqlo, this new thing that's showing up, they've got some really spiffy fabrics that seem kind of high-tech but not high-priced.
Well, certainly Uniqlo's first selling point, when it came into the market was its sort of techno fabrics, particularly its really, really light kind of down jackets and the heat tech long underwear for skiing and then the cool you down stuff for sports during the summer.
Yeah.
And, that has really kept that edge. And in fact, Japanese fabric technology in general is very on the forefront of everything that's happening now. It also has a kind of edge often of sustainability in that these are done in much cleaner ways than some of the older polyesters. And that's a real selling point.
Do you mean constructed or the factory end of it?
No, they're making the fabrics. They're manufacturing them in very clean factories.
So high tech. Mm-hmm.
And, certainly for millennials, sustainability, environmental awareness is a big selling point.
Liz in Somerville, Massachusetts. Liz, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I missed the last part of what you just said, but my comment is that when you buy something in one place, like at Gap or whatever, and I suddenly think, oh, I really like this pair of jeans, and I'm going to buy five more of them, right?
Yeah.
A lot of times.
Seems like a lot, but okay.
Yeah. Well, women are crazy about that sort of thing.
Good. Okay,
but,
good.
But that they're made in different countries, that they contract out in different countries, or different factories. So when you buy something at, say, the Gap in Cambridge, and then I get four more, it comes from somewhere else, and they don't fit or feel the same. And I don't really feel like you're addressing the conditions of the manufacturers.
We'll look at that, Liz. Suzanne, what about it? Many people are online are asking about the conditions in which these clothes are made and the workers who are doing it. Is it sweatshop? What about working conditions? And what about consistency of product, Suzanne?
Well, there has been a lot of attention on the working conditions of these factories as we've seen some of these factory collapses in Bangladesh that have killed thousands of people. It's not good, but The hope is that some of these tragedies are shining light on the issues, and a lot of the big garment manufacturers, both in the U.S. and Europe, have banded together. They've created funds. They're trying to put some standards in place, but it's so very complicated to ensure that, you have sort of standard conditions. They use multiple factories across many, many countries. You don't have the garment employees, the apparel companies, they don't have their executives in these factories all the time policing. And so they can put standards in place, but then, the factory owner is under pressure to meet a certain volume. They're getting squeezed on price. They're trying to, up their shipments, and they may, sacrifice safety to get an order out. And it just seems like we're in this cycle where, a lot of these people work in really, really horrible conditions.
Is fast fashion more guilty than anything, than the old style order a year in advance, or is it all the same, Suzanne?
I don't think there's that much of a distinction. I think that, it's just basically Americans or, consumers have become conditioned to expect cheap clothes. And, companies are scrambling to, they can't really raise prices. So as you see labor costs rising in China, that just creates more pressure on the system, and it's not good for the factory worker.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the clothes we buy, the world of retail that brings them, and kind of upheaval going on in the land of Gap, J. Crew, and more. We are the species that wraps ourselves in cloth every day. Those fashions make a statement, and behind it, a very, very large industry that has big impacts on all kinds of people all over the world, the way they work, the way they interact, what you end up wearing. Vanessa Friedman is with us. She's chief fashion critic at the New York Times. Suzanne Kapner is here. She covers retail for the Wall Street Journal. Liz Dunn is with us from Talmadge Advisors, retail industry consultant. Frank in New Bedford, Massachusetts. Frank, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I used to work at the Gap about 3 years ago. No, I'm sorry, not three years ago, but some time ago.
Okay.
And I definitely noticed that the quality of the clothes has changed. Even today, not even just the Gap, other stores, I wonder what's going on in the cotton industry, because it almost seems like a research project to find items that are 100% cotton.
Just not out there? Quality, Vanessa, are you willing to make that kind of broad stroke critique of quality across the mid-market?
I think it's hard to assess the quality of every single garment out there. And, you know, and it is, as Suzanne said, you know, there are tons and tons of moving parts in the supply chain and many different concerns. So I think, you know, quality is clearly an issue, but you probably need a lot more information for that.
Can we talk about how individual designers drive the look of what millions of people end up wearing when it comes to this? Not, you know, we know the runway and the really high-end fashion. You know that very well, of course, better than I. But when it comes to what people wear every day, you've had individual designers come into some of these huge companies and really change the look of how the population is wrapped every day, dressed every day. How big a role does that play, Vanessa?
It's incredibly important. You know, there's always, whether you call it a designer, a creative director, an artistic director, executive vice president in charge of design, you know, there are all sorts of titles out there. There's always a person who is really in charge of the visual identity of a brand, and that covers garments, it covers the way stores look, it covers advertising, marketing, any, you know, social media, any kind of online visual imagery. And so that, you know, that idea, that vision is incredibly important. And, you know, certainly with J. Crew, it was instrumental in first transforming it from what was effectively a catalog company into something that was considered a fashion brand.
So when I look at J. Crew in the last few years, I don't get into that often, but when I do, they seem to have gone ever more into this sort of hyper preppy look, at least on the men's side. It's almost as though they wanted to be the clothiers to the era of inequality, the higher prices and more sort of, you know, dress this kind of, I don't know, faux aristocracy. Would that be some individual's thematic take on the world?
I think it would be a combination of, you know, the corporate and creative direction of the brand, which is clearly, you know, Mickey Drexler, who's CEO, and Jenna Lyons, who is in charge of design. And, you know, it worked for them for a very, very long time. You can't dispute that.
Mm-hmm.
But they did become more and more ambitious in fashion terms, you know, to the extent where with women's wear, they were presenting during New York Fashion Week in the tents where the runway shows are. And I think, you know, that was probably a source of confusion for a lot of consumers.
So what happened? I mean, there were a lot of women who just depended on this. It was their go-to for a long time. Was there a new designer brought in or a new sensibility put to work that had people jumping out the windows?
In a way, I don't think it was that it was new. I think it was too much the same.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was this huge surprise when Jenna first came in, and it became kind of sequiny and bright and patterned and different and exciting. And then, you know, they did more of the same, which is generally what designers do when something works well. But you reach a kind of tipping point where more of the same becomes same old, same old.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that happened a bit with J. Crew, that people got tired of seeing stripe sequins all the time. And they wanted something that was kind of more surprising and more different, and they weren't seeing that.
Elizabeth in Middlebury, Vermont. Elizabeth, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, great. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks.
So I think there's a really important part of this conversation that you touched on earlier, but I'm not hearing a lot about, and that's how consumer sort of social justice and values are shaping this conversation and mm-hmm. shaping the market.
Mm-hmm.
I personally buy almost exclusively from Patagonia and Eileen Fisher, and I do that because I see two brands that really take into account sort of the carbon footprint and the ecological footprint and the social justice piece of an industry that is hugely consumptive, hugely wasteful, creates an extraordinary amount of toxins, and I see my friends doing the same. And so I'd like to think that folks like us are starting to shape how this, you know, J. Crew is, you've talked about it, and Gap is very throwaway, and I think there are those of us that are trying to kind of change this industry a little bit and hopefully affect the market.
Elizabeth, how do you do your homework? I mean, how do you know who's got the really sustainable product? And I guess...
I'm a professional researcher, actually. I'm a PhD student, so it's what I, you know, a lot of online time, and so I've been following these companies for a while, and I've read Yvon Chouinard's books, I try to make really good decisions with my life, and so a lot of online research.
So you basically make it your business to know. You better know, because I saw Patagonia catalog the other day, just flipped through it. Again, to me, the prices were really high, so it better be...
I know, and that's the thing. Like, you buy a couple of pieces. I mean, this is how I do it, right?
Okay.
You buy a couple of pieces. You buy them maybe a couple times a year when you want to update or something. But I don't do it that often. The designs are classic. They stay. I can beat the heck out of my clothing if I need to. And I invest. It's an investment. I don't think of it as this thing that I'm going to toss away when the fashion switches or in 6 months when I get sick of it. So it's a different approach, I guess. But I see a lot of my peer community is doing the same thing.
More sustainable, more social justice in your closet and in its origins. I appreciate your call, Elizabeth. Liz Dunn, take us inside the world of retail and fashion. Do you have the big bosses sitting around thinking about this, or are they looking just to churn out high volume? Does that kind of attitude that Elizabeth is expressing and her readiness to do the homework to figure out who does what and how, does it affect the decisions about what gets made and where and how?
Yeah, it's a real dilemma because, you know, obviously most of these companies are driving for growth. That's what their shareholders want to see. And how do you do that while not necessarily feeding into a frenzied consumer who is just buying for the sake of buying? One of the phrases that came out of the recession was this idea of the new normal. And the new normal is we're not going to be as careless about our spending patterns, and we're not maybe. I know we had one caller who called in and said she was going to buy five pairs of jeans, but mm-hmm. that's not the norm anymore. And so, I think that what retailers are attempting to do is answer these questions and concerns that consumers have, but try to do so in a way that they can still grow. And so, you know, you get to situations like J. Crew where they raised prices a little bit and were attempting to raise quality. And that's one way you can achieve sales growth while maybe not necessarily growing units quite as fast. But, I mean, obviously it backfired. But it's a big dilemma. Zara has spent, or Inditex has spent, a lot of time trying to lower their carbon footprint. And they don't even like to be lumped in the group of fast fashion because they're really not attempting to just churn out more and more cheap clothes that people buy too many of. So, you know, I think it's an increasingly loud conversation in the boardroom.
It can have a big impact on how we use the resources that are out there and how quickly it's all just thrown away. Ben in Atlanta, Georgia. Ben, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes. I probably have it just like a little bit easier than the average female that's out there, but I only own about 2 to 3 dozen articles of clothing at a time, and I go to the store about once a week or so, and I cycle out clothes that I've worn consistently almost every week or so, and then I find out about how much it's been worn out, and then I go and I buy new clothes, and then I send that clothes to consignment. So my spreadsheet kind of tells me what fits me well and what kind of gives me the most value. But there's still no easy way to go and find out if that clothing is creative in a responsible way or not. I can do my own research on the value side, but I'm still wanting to be conscientious about it's the most cost-effective and the most durable for me, but is it actually are socially conscious as well.
Brother Ben, did you say spreadsheet? Do you actually have a spreadsheet to keep track of your clothing?
Yeah, I'm a project manager by trade, so I'm always looking for like efficiencies, and I do a spreadsheet for my gas mileage and my light bulbs as well, so it's not anything special.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Well, not for a project manager, maybe. Vanessa, what about this idea of maybe this is the quintessence of fast fashion, just two or three dozen articles of clothing and cycling them out, i.e. tossing them and buying new ones as often as every week? That's fast fashion in action.
It's the Jack Reacher school of wardrobing.
What did Jack Reacher
read those
do that?
Books? he wears one thing and then he throws it away and gets another thing.
Okay.
You know, it's interesting because there are a couple websites which I encourage anyone who's interested in this to go see. One is Honest Buy, and the other is Zadie, and they actually list where everything that goes into a garment originates. So they'll tell you the factory, the kind of cotton, where the buttons come from. You know, in Honest Buy even includes their own markup.
Honest Buy and also Zadie, Z-A-D-I-E,
Zadie,
will tell
Z-A-D-Y.
Z-A-D-Y, okay. If you want to learn origins, that's cool.
You know, and it's really interesting to see the reaction to them, which, you know, some consumers, I mean, they're small, but people have really embraced this kind of complete transparency with garment manufacture. And, you know, it may be that this is, in fact, the wave of the future, and gradually there will be more and more pressure on the bigger companies to, you know, give out more information, readily accessible, easy to digest, about where garments come from.
I wonder if that changes fashion as well. Does that drive out, I don't know, embroidery or brocade or things that are labor-intensive to produce if you're trying to have a light footprint on the earth?
Well, not at all. I mean, I think it depends how you view value, you know, but certainly supporting communities where handwork is done, be it in India or Pakistan, or Africa, is, you know, often seen as a very good thing. And that is something that fashion can do. Then you have to offset that with whatever it costs, you know, in terms of carbon footprint to bring the garment from its point of origin to the store, you know, which is part of the complication of the fashion supply chain. And it really does require each consumer to decide, you know, what is important to them, what they care most about, and then make those judgments for themselves.
Here's Ma Nam writing to us online, Vanessa. It says, the thing with Gap, J. Crew, Banana Republic, they all look so shapeless and bland, a lot of beige, gray, faded colors, very boring, Manam writes, compared to Europe and the rest of the world. What do you say to that, Vanessa?
I say normcore.
What does that mean?
You know, I say that there is always a consumer who wants a white t-shirt, a pair of jeans, a button-down. You know, there's a market for those kind of clothes. Mm-hmm. It's not the garments themselves that are necessarily, or the idea of that kind of a garment that is bad. It is that, as a whole, the message itself was so bland and that it did feel ubiquitous, boring, not special. You know, all the things that drive consumers away.
Linda in Sterling Heights, Michigan. Linda, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, how you doing?
Okay.
I just want to say I shop exclusively online, and first off, you can never have enough white t-shirts.
Okay.
But, and also on the thing about buying more than one item, you know, the gal that bought five pairs of jeans, sometimes I do buy three, four of an item, because sometimes you never know if you're going to be able to get the item again. If you find something that you really like and it fits well, then I will buy three or four of them, sometimes even more.
It's not like the old days of Levi's that would be there on the shelf in the same style for decades sometimes, I guess. Linda, I appreciate your call. Liz Dunn, maybe in the fast fashion era, maybe it's not as wild as it sounds to buy multiples, because tomorrow the whole thing may be gone.
Yeah, I actually had a dress that I bought recently from Zara that I wish I had bought multiples, because, yeah, it was gone the next time I went back. But you know, I think that back to the comment about these companies kind of being boring, the normcore thing was it's still happening. But Gap's interpretation of that was, I think, a big mistake. Their sort of dress normal campaign really emphasized that the company had boring clothes. And I think that was a big backfire in terms of a marketing message.
Maybe it's norm, but don't make it a boring norm, please. Mark in Green Bay, just time for you, Mark. You're on.
Well, hi, Tom. Well, I'm the least fashion-conscious person in the world at dress and rags, but I'm wondering if advances in material sciences and nanofibers, smart clothing, is going to have us all wearing Star Trekian togas into the future.
Vanessa Friedman, Star Trekkian togas of fabulous fabric in our future. What do you say, Vanessa?
I say when that happens, I will probably no longer be here.
What can a fashion designer say? But maybe it won't be simply about design. Maybe we'll get into some more standardization, but within all kinds of features of fabric that blow our minds in other ways.
You know, I think certainly with wearables, which is what we're talking about, you know, the possibilities are kind of exciting and at the moment completely kind of fantastical. And we don't really know where it's going to take us, but it will be interesting to see.
Do you expect that we're going to continue to see retail giants out there? Will they be the old retail giants? Is Gap slowly going away? Does it get reborn?
I think the retail model that we have been used to, you know, for the last couple decades, wherein once a brand is successful, it opens more and more and more stores mm-hmm. so that it can reach people in different markets, even if the market's only two streets over from the old market, is probably over. And that's really what this is about in large part, you know, that there will be a new retail model which sees fewer stores that will be more and more special, that will be this thing the brands like to call experiences, giving people a reason to go in, and then there will be a big e-commerce part. And that's how things will develop.
There, ladies and gentlemen, the future coming very rapidly at you. Vanessa Friedman, fashion director, chief fashion critic at the New York Times. Vanessa, thanks a lot for joining us today. Wonderful to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Liz Dunn at Talmadge Advisors in New York. Thank you so much for your insights, Liz.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And Suzanne Kapner at the Wall Street Journal in New York. Suzanne, thanks for getting us all up to date here. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Listeners, in this hour tomorrow, we will sit down with the brand new U.S. Poet Laureate, Juan Felipe Herrera, first Latino Poet Laureate of the United States. Join us for that. Join us anytime online. Get our podcast there at onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.